This is the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 43, recorded March 17th, 2013. Week of Tools. Yeah, hi, it's another episode of the Coconetics Podcast, and just like last week, I've got Dave with me, David Mendels. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Oliver. How are you doing?
Oh, fine, thank you. How has your week been?
The week has been very busy, but we're getting towards the end of it. That's pretty cool, actually. Good programming, very good surprises from my staff, so all perfect.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned previously you've got some follow-up about our previous topic, women in technology.
Yes. So quick follow-up, actually. I am very happy because I'm interviewing next week my first potential female professor. And for some reason, so yeah, people who listened to us last week may have realized that I'm in Southeast Asia, so we've got a big time difference. I think we finished the podcast last week for me around 1:30 a.m. and my ideas were not really clear, so I completely missed some points. Some of the great points, actually, when we talked about getting more women in tech is that... Well, first of all, if you've got women in your group already, it's easier for you to get more women in your group.
So women will come where women already are.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an obviousness that that people often miss. But if you've already got women in your group, they create an environment that is more suitable to women.
So that's like with money, where they say you need money to make money.
Exactly.
You need women to have more women.
Yes.
And by the way, I hope you don't have too many smart ideas that you forgot, because I recorded another a podcast since we talked. I did that with a young lady that is a cousin of mine, and we did that in German. And I was using many of the things that you told me to reference, like this thing with the 20-year-old and so on. So if you now have many more great things, then it's a little bit sad because I could have used them in my other podcast. But never mind.
Okay, bye. I can still discuss with your cousin directly. So yeah, the other thing that I wanted to mention is that we are creating as well in the university a kindergarten. So that's not bring your own phone to work. That's bring your kid to work. And the idea is to make work frictionless for women. I think that's very important, actually, not only for, well, it's important for kids, because life of women is not so easy when they've got kids. I mean, they take up a lot of your time. And it's important as well for, the rest of the stuff, meaning, you should have proper facilities for women. It should not be a machist environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine certainly nowadays there will also be male professors that might make use of a kindergarten if they have if they have kids.
Yes,
it's at work.
I would say so. Yeah. But for in particular, you know, for women that are nursing their baby, that's they may feel that they've got to take some more time off until the baby is out of mother's milk, and that is not really necessary. So those were the points that I thought were quite important that I forgot completely last week. And for this show, we've got some pretty nice topics to discuss, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned that you noticed, and I think I noticed this as well, this past week, many, well, the topic of the past week seemed to be many new tools coming into our lives as developers. And so what new tools or what new versions of old tools have you specifically spotted?
So I've been playing this week with Crashlytics.
Crashlytics, they are a sponsor of several podcasts that I'm listening to. So far, I haven't given them a try, but hey, tell me, what do you think is great about it?
So, first of all, it does a really good job at reporting crashes with something that is quite fantastic. It gives you the full state of your threads when it crashes. So if we start, if we roll back a little bit, the sign up and the download are spotless. Adding Crashlytics to your app is quite a feat. It's a really nice experience. That's the first time really that I've got, we've got the icon of Crashlytics once you've downloaded the app that that comes up in the menu bar, from which you're just going to, you've got that pop-up box and you're going to drag and drop the framework from there into your app directly in Xcode. So that's very much Mac-like, if you want. That's the first one that
I... Sorry, I got distracted there. The last thing I heard was something about the Crashlytics icon. Could you...
Yeah. So you've got the small Crashlytics icon that is in the menu bar. Tap on it and you've got a pop-up that is... Or click on it since we're on a Mac. You've got a pop-up that is coming up and that pop-up will help you set up your Xcode project so that you include the Crashlytics
SDK
framework into your app. Then after that, compile and run as usual. And when it crashes, you get the crash report that is in a web interface, for which you got first of all, you can sort by versions, you can sort by open and closed issues, and you can sort by time. Now it gives you the number of issues, the number of crashes for that issue, and the number of users that are affected. And what I love about it is that it indicates which line in your code has crashed.
So how does it know which kinds of crashes belong to certain issues?
I've got no idea.
Oh,
I don't
magic.
Know how they are doing it. That's magic for me right now. That's just magic. I've tried it extensively. I've simulated some crashes as well. And it works really well.
Well, probably the same kind of crashes are then grouped into one issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's pretty powerful. That's real time as well. The thing I find quite fascinating, apart from the fact that it reports the right line of code where this happened, is that you get to act on it almost in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Great design, great idea. I don't know how they're doing it, but I'm definitely going to use it, and I think that's pretty cool.
All right. That's about Crashlytics. The other thing that was new in the past week, and many people that I'm following on Twitter mentioned that that's actually functionality that they would have expected for Apple to build into Xcode. The tool that I'm talking about is DeployMate. And what is supposed to do is scan your app for uses of new SDK methods that if not checked would cause your app to crash on older iPhone apps. And you probably have had this also happen in the past, that you published an app, got it approved by Apple, because Apple only tests apps on the latest iOS version, and then you get crash reports from users, or well, remarks on the comments that the app immediately crashes on when they try to launch it. And it turns out, once you see the crash, that it's a thing like a unrecognized selector, which happens if you call a method that doesn't exist on this iOS version. And that's something that's quite embarrassing. We're supposed to test on old iOS devices, but well, it always happens, yeah. And if there's some sort of help that gives me a warning, then that's quite helpful. And Crashlytics was released. They charge $10 for it, and you tried it out.
Oh yeah, I did.
So
yeah, I did. And
what is your impression?
I think it's really neat, actually. It's really neat. I haven't tested it extensively, because I just picked it up this week from a blog post from Mugund Kumar.
Mm-hmm.
I tried it, and I tried it actually on one project that had that problem. So I went back to that one and looked at what happened. And that was a 6.0 with a target back to 5.1, and it picked the problem really easily.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty cool. I tried it as well on one of my projects that has not been updated for a long time, and was still under 4.2, and it picked all the issues as well very well. So that's something that is really neat, and it's true that Xcode could have benefited from that kind of facility. I don't know why it's not included within Xcode.
Well, speaking of this. Whenever there's some cool functionality that we are missing from Xcode, you know what you're supposed to do as a developer? File a radar. And so I did. I filed a radar. I'm going to put the link to the blog post in the show notes. And it basically says, dear Apple, please give us the functionality to warn about such potential issues, and as a proof that this actually is possible, have a look at deployment app. And so
now that's an interesting issue, because Apple clearly encourages us not to support old versions, not to deploy for example 5.1.
Well, what makes you say that, actually?
Well, the fact that if you're installing, let's say that you get a fresh, brand new Mac, and you install Xcode on it, it's got that difficult to find, for example, 5.1 to install in the simulator.
Well, it's just a download, isn't it? So
it is a download, but it's tricky to find it, I think. They don't make it easy to find the older versions in the developer portal.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think it would be something like 10 minutes to locate it in the developer portal, and I had to go to Stack Overflow actually to find the link. So definitely not cool.
Mm. Yeah, they probably want people to target the most modern iOS versions, but still, it is possible, and I don't think they intentionally not provide such warnings. It's just that I don't think that it's been a priority for them, and if nobody sends them a radar wishing for this kind of functionality, then they, where should they get the idea from?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking it's also our job as developers to tell them what we want to see in the IDE.
Yeah. Probably. You're probably right. Yeah. Although I definitely think that, well, the one thing that we should mention is that if you're putting out one app nowadays, that's your first version, I would strongly encourage you to just support 6.1. And do not care about iOS 5.
Yeah, we do that actually from I think like 2 months ago. All the new apps that we put out, we evaluate whether it makes sense to release them with iOS 5 support. But generally nowadays, if you are starting a new app, I think iOS 6 is good enough, and it gives you many advantages, not the least of which are auto layout support. And, well, it is quite painful if you started an app with layout constraints in the interface builder, and then you decide, oh, I still want to support iOS 5, and then you have to go in and remove all the auto layout and add auto resizing struts and what's it called? Struts and bolts? No, struts and blah.
Struts and springs.
Springs, genau. Yeah. So, yeah. If you can, then target iOS 6. But the reality is, most of us have many apps already released. And as I said before, it happened to a colleague of mine. We had one app that had such a crash, and it's always embarrassing if you then have to ask Apple for an app expedited review so that you get the crash fix out as quickly as possible, and then you get this email saying it's only a one-off thing, and you better do sufficient quality assurance the next time. Yeah, so they make you feel really, really bad.
Yeah, I've received that one as well. The jargon may vary, but it's funny actually. I got one. I can remember I got one something like 2 years ago. The queue was officially 4 days, I think, and they answered the expedited review after 3. So that was not even worth asking yet, but. But I still did because there was a stupid crash and that was a crash that involved VoiceOver, so I felt really bad for the visually impaired users.
Mm.
But they do that expedited review thing. I don't know if it's really worth it nowadays, but because the queue is 6 days, and I think it will probably remain like this. Yeah.
Well, we've had several instances where an app of ours had to be ready for a trade fair because the client wanted to ship the app or the new update right at the very first day of the trade fair, so that they can say, now today we unveil the new version. And then you have to make use of an expedited thing, because if you do it a little bit in advance and then you get it approved like 2 days before the trade fair, then you find, oh shit, there's a crash. and so, yeah, you still want to get it in. And we the last time we did that, it was actually at the beginning of the day of the trade fair, it was released. We discovered the crash, and at the end of the day, the first day of the trade fair, we already had the fix approved by an expedited review. So that worked quite well, actually.
That's nice. Well, that's where we can see that you're Australian, meaning that you're well organized and everything. So you had the thing posted and approved well ahead. Well, 2 days is well ahead of the fair. I've had so another anecdote. I got once a customer who wanted to go to a fair that was a literary fair, with an app that I was developing, and they kept asking for small changes, until we missed the date for the last submission where we would get the app before the fair. And then they just told me, hey, listen, that's not a problem. You're going to talk to the engineer who's doing that for our partner, and he will install on 8 iPads on the stand. So can you do this via test flight? And boy, oh boy, the engineer, it was the first time he had any Apple gear in his hands.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. And it took me 2 days on a phone with the guy. At that time, we didn't, so he didn't understand test flight. And the only thing he wanted to do was install it manually. I guess the guy is still trying to look for a floppy drive. And I had to do the whole shebang with him, so sending basically the IPA and the provisioning profiles, etc. That took us 2 days by phone. Horrible.
There's this one tool while we're speaking of tools that I would love to have a chance to actually try out someday, but never had a reason to do so. That is the app that Apple provides for provisioning devices. Like, say you have a bunch of iPod Touches or iPads in a school, what you can do with their, what's it called, App Enterprise Manager Configuration Tool, something like this, where you basically specify what iOS version should be on it, what profiles, what wireless networking setup, what VPN, what apps, and then what you do is while you plug in the devices, and that can be via a USB hub, it can be 12 devices or so, while you plug them in and while they charge, they are all basically wiped and put back to a certain state. So what you can do is, if it's at school, everything is basically reset. Or one other example where they showed this in use was for ticket scanning app for a movie theater, where they had like iPads in a thick sleeve that also had a barcode scanner on it, and so every day they would plug these into a docking station, and that would reset the device, put on the software as it should be, so you would never have an unexpected state of the device. And that's a tool that's been provided by Apple.
Yeah, and that's one that we're going to implement in the inner city, because we're getting iPads for all our students. Now, if everything you said is true, there's just one small problem with this app, at least, is that I cannot buy 3,000 versions of, well, I can buy 3,000 versions of Pages and get them installed automatically. But I cannot buy 3,000 versions of, say, Instapaper and remotely install them myself as an administrator. Meaning that for our students, we've got to buy to have group purchases for the apps that we want to add, and then we will give them a code for these apps to the students. Otherwise, we're just going to spend 5 man-months just setting up each single iPad with the apps that we want to add.
Yeah, it makes more sense if everybody takes care of this themselves.
Yeah. On the other hand, we still get to manage the devices, not only when they're plugged, but also wirelessly, which is pretty cool. And when you take a large number of devices, actually, you also get someone from Apple to manage the part of devices, because that's a daunting task in the end. But yeah, that looks like a pretty cool tool. If only it could be extended in Xcode to cover the features of TestFlight, that would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, I think you can. Can't you do the same kind of app distribution, ad hoc distribution, that you can over the air that TestFlight is using, where you have an EPA and then you can install this?
Yeah, but with the school account, we're getting 200 devices on which we can run. And if we want more, we've got to buy additional accounts or ask for permissions from Apple to extend that. But to be very honest, I think that's possible because they're very supportive. But at some point, you must just think, you know, if there's a limit there, there is a reason. And the reason is essentially that you're never going to be able to manage a deployment to 3,000 people like that.
Well, you could get an enterprise account.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get an enterprise account. And then, for these ones, I don't know what's the limit. If there's a limit of the number of devices or not.
Actually, there is. I once had this information somewhere. Let me check. I made a presentation also on a trade fair. Let me see if I can find the chart. That was team. I had a sorry that it's take.
I seem to remember that it's either 500 or 5,000. I don't remember which one it is.
Mm-hmm. There it is. Enterprise means unlimited in-house, and teams. But I don't think enterprise is actually limited. The only limit there is that you cannot publish App Store apps with an enterprise account. I don't think you have a limit as to the devices that you can distribute to.
That's interesting. Let me just try that.
The only thing is it costs a bit of money. It's $299 per year.
Yeah, that's peanuts. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, $99 or $299, that's not a big difference. The $99, by the way, I've always felt that they were weird, but they were just the anti-trolling measure that they got in place.
Say again, what did you say just now?
The $99 for a developer account, I've always felt that this was weird, particularly when they set Xcode for free. You know, when was that? That was a year ago or 2 years ago? I don't remember.
I think has mainly two reasons. One reason is it's an artificial barrier to entry to prevent everybody from signing up. So basically what the numbers that they have now are probably for the most part serious developers. And the second reason is you get tech support incidents per year per account, basically, or per, for example, I have a Mac developer account and an iOS developer account, and for each of these I get 2 tech incidents, but I also pay $100 per each, and one such incident has a value of about $75. So you basically get a value of $150 for the price of $100.
Yeah.
So
have you used them?
I use them. I try to use them every year, though it's a bit of a management thing. Every time Apple starts reminding me that I should pay the next installment for the next year, then I have a look to see how many incidents I've left, and if I have a burning question, then I'll try to make use of these. Because otherwise they are wasted. You don't carry them over to the next year, and you usually get great answers.
Oh yes, the quality of it. The quality of the engineers at the other end is unquestionable. Definitely, I've always been very, very. Well, the first time I was very surprised actually that the answer was that full. For people who are listening and who never filed one, they take care of you as the genius would take care of you in an Apple store.
Let me just share my first time I filed a tech support incident. I was asking for if there's some sort of example how I could slide in a date picker from the bottom of the screen for picking a date to be put in a table view cell. So imagine you have a table view, and one of these rows has a date, and you tap on this, and then you want to have a date picker come in from the bottom, select the date, and if you tap on another cell, it should slide out again. And so that was basically my question. And the answer I got, I think like 2 or 3 days later, was, yeah, I've got this sample that I've been working on that does exactly this. And yeah, then he sent me the sample. And this sample is actually available on the Apple website. If you look for, I think, date pick or something, it's basically exactly what I asked for. And it's also available as sample code. So if as a sample that they are working on or an existing sample can solve your problem, then that's a great thing, because you don't have to think kind of one step after the other, but you get basically finished source code that you can copy paste into your app. And also if it's a bit more involved, you never pay more. They never say, okay, that's now worth 2 incidents because you have been such a pain in the ass.
No, that never happens, fortunately.
The one thing that can happen, and it did happen to me for one incident, was that they didn't have an answer. Because there was one problem I had with PDF on Mac, and basically the answer was that there is no answer at present. So, usually if they start investigating and then find that there's no solution to your problem, you won't get your support incident back. It's only one thing that you can do is basically a sort of a trick. You can send them the tech incident together with a reference to a radar you have filed, and you can say, is this a bug? And if they then say, yes, this is a bug, but don't have to do any kind of investigating on top of that, then you get credited back to the support incident. So there are some cases where you can use a support incident to actually quickly get the information that something you see as a bug is really a bug. And, well, then from there you can proceed and say, okay, is there a workaround? And usually there might be one, and then that's the help you get for your tech incident. But in my case, unfortunately, I didn't get my incident back, and I also didn't get a solution because there was none at the time.
Hate those ones.
So there's
a way around.
let's get back to our topic of Week of Tools. There's one more that you mentioned that's been entered into the beta stage.
Yeah, so Buildozer, that's Buildozer, like a build, Buildozer.io. I'll send you the link for the show notes. I signed up for it. I'm waiting for clearance from the people from, that's the people from Egenic, so they're Dutch. And they got that thing that seems very interesting. It's like Test Flight on steroids. So it does automatic builds, apparently. And so you give them access, basically. Once you push code to your repository, they will do automatically the build and the distribution to your testers. And the one thing that that seems very promising to me is that it's already integrated with GitHub and SVN, and they are doing a proper validation for it for the builds as well. So it looks like a great time saver, and I'm really longing to testing it. Hopefully next week. That's pretty cool.
So do you know? Do they publish via their own system or via Test Flight?
Right now, that's via their own system, and they will integrate it with Test Flight in the future. That's what the website says. Apparently, I don't know how far they are right now, but right now, that's their own system. Apparently, I'll hopefully know more about it in a few days or weeks. I've seen as well on Twitter that that you were talking about GitHub. I've seen that you've changed your you've finally moved out of SVN.
Well, let me tell you about that. I've got two places, basically two kinds of repositories where my source code is in. I've got my open source projects, which are on GitHub, public repositories. Yeah. I want people to see the source code, use it, if they use it commercially, maybe buy a non-attribution license, contribute to it. Now, that's the one thing. I've got several components that I'm selling, not the least of which is a rich text editing component. And these, so far, I had hosted on my own server in a Subversion repository. And it was Subversion because originally, before I moved to a CentOS Linux server, I had a Windows server, and there a friend had installed Visual SVN as a Subversion repository. And so basically when I moved to a Linux server, I figured, okay, let's just keep that Subversion. And it was, well, Git wasn't really something that I heard of before. So I was happy with that for a while. But well, in direct comparison with Git, Subversion has one advantage for me, but many disadvantages. So the one advantage is I have a central canonical place where I'm controlling access to for the components. So for the longest time, I saw that as a big advantage, so that people wouldn't go and everybody have a clone of the full history of the repository. So my thinking was, okay, I have it sort of under control. There are a few people that I know of who have their source code in private GitHub repositories. Though I have to admit, I feel a bit uneasy with putting my proprietary things, the things that I'm making money with, on GitHub. Not that I wouldn't trust them, but every once in a while their service goes down, and it's just a thing. If I can host my source code on my own server somehow, I have more control over it. So I had my admin set up a Git server for me, and Well, there are basically like three or four choices that you have when you want to host your own Git server besides using Git itself. So what you can always do is just put Git on a server and then use this directly, but then you don't have any sort of front end. So usually you want to have some sort of web-based administration, and you want to see colored diffs and have issues and so on. So for this, you need to have a front end. You can't just use Git by itself. But if you're kind of a Linux geek and you live and breathe in the terminal, then Git itself would be fine for you probably as well. Now, yes, I belong to...
You cannot reach it via SourceStream if you're hosting it yourself?
I don't understand your question.
Have you tried SourceStream to manage your Git? That's a GUI for it.
Oh, GUI. No, I haven't tried that.
Okay.
I've been using Git from the command line myself uh-huh. since I started with it. I've briefly tried out the integration that's in Xcode, and for committing individual files, I'm now using Xcode for the most part. So if I made a change in one file and want to commit that, so I right click on the file that has a status of M yeah. for modified, enter my commit message and that's it. So that's what I do, but I don't like to use an extra app. But what I'm talking about is actually not uh-huh. not the interaction from the developer point of view, but what you have on GitHub that you see individual commits of other people, that you can have merge requests, that you can have issues, that if you for example on GitHub, if you have issue number 3, app crashes mm-hmm. when I do this, and then in the commit message you can say blah 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 fixes #3, then as soon as you push that to your origin, it will also mm-hmm. close the issue, and it will be referenced in the issue, so the people who are watching the issue will see there is a commit that fixes this, and so everybody is informed. Now mm-hmm. If I had limitless money, what I would love to do is actually have a GitHub Enterprise installation. So if you have $5,000, you can install the original GitHub software on your own server.
Uh-huh.
The level from which on this makes sense is if you have 20 developers or more. Because uh-huh. 20 seats is basically the minimum that you can... buy from GitHub. Okay. Now, I don't have $5,000 per year, that is. So the next best thing is to choose one of the other Git servers and frontends that are out there. The first that I had a look at was Gitorious, or some people call it Gitorchus.
This one is quite famous, actually.
It's quite famous. It was the first thing that came to mind. But honestly, I didn't like the style, and it was causing many problems for me. Because we are running our source repository server in a virtual machine on the actual Linux server. And mm-hmm. also, I want to use a certificate to have the HTTP traffic encrypted, and Gitorious had many issues with that. Okay. So in the end, it didn't feel right. It felt kind of like a weird cross between, you have a little bit of Git, but for the most part, it looks like a WordPress template. And mm-hmm. I didn't like the colors. And so in the end, I asked on Twitter what people are using, and I got... two responses, basically. One was basically GitLab. Uh-huh. And there's a system that GitLab is basing on. I think it's called Gitorious. No, not Gitorious. Well, I don't remember. It says so if you go on the front page of GitLab. It's basically based on two other things. And what GitLab does is it looks very, very close to GitHub. So there are many things, many mechanics from the UI that you know from GitHub, and it's just delightful to discover those in there. So to give one example, you know, on GitHub you have this network graph where you see the forks and the merges that you do from your code. So you would see there's a point when a branch goes down, then there are a few commits to this, and then this branch goes back into the master branch, and GitLab has the same thing as well. And we put a very, very large 20 megabytes source code repository that before we had on a Subversion, we put on GitLab, and there you could see all the, my colleague is basically tagging everything and branching for everything, and you could see this graph was really showing lots of branches and how they went together again. And what another thing that's great that GitLab,
you managed to import your branches, you managed to import the SVN directly into GitLab.
It's not direct. What you need to do is there's a guide in the Git book that's mm-hmm. available online for free. There's some steps that you need to do. So the first step is you need to get a list of the committers to the Subversion repository, and mm-hmm. you need to basically create a mapping, because in Subversion you don't use the people's email address, whereas in Git a user is defined by the email address. So you have to say, okay, the user Ode Robnik now mm-hmm. should be Oliver@coconetics.com. So okay. you provide that with a mapping file. The second okay. thing you need to there's a short terminal statement that you run that basically converts the Subversion tags into Git tags and the mm-hmm. Subversion branches into Git branches. So once you have done that and you do the whole thing with a tool that's called Git minus SVN. So it's mm-hmm. basically a Subversion client that internally uses Git. So after you have done all of that, you end up with a fully fledged Git repository. And once you have that, you just add the remote of your Git server and push to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have everything that you had on Subversion now on your Git server. Now, let me just say for completeness, another thing that I didn't like on Gitorious was you could every user could fork your project into his own private space, but then there was no easy way for you to merge back in changes that this user made. So mm-hmm. the process that they tell you you should do is basically, you have to add as a remote this other user's fork, have to pull from there, preferably into a branch. And once you're satisfied, you then merge this branch into your master, and this then you push to your own repository, and then you still have to manually close the merge request on the website. So it's very a tedious process. I can imagine why they did it like that, because it's similar to what GitHub did for a while until they introduced this green online merge button. So I think it was like half a year ago or so that GitHub introduced this ability to just push on a green button in a pull request to merge the changes in, and Gitorious never got around to do that.
I cannot tell you the number of time in Git where just to do that I had to get back to the command line and fix errors in the terminal, which I hate doing. when Git is broken, that's a bad day for everyone.
Mm. Now, the same process looks a little bit different on GitLab. You wouldn't create a fork into a private space, but all the users that you allow into a certain project can create branches on this very project, but they cannot write to master. So you can write protect certain branches. So the big advantage there is everybody has the original repository and has all the branches that the people are working on. So for example, if you are implementing a certain feature, you push this, you commit this onto a local feature branch, and then you push this local feature branch into a feature branch that's on the repository. Similar then to GitHub, you can create a merge request for your changes that you put into this branch, and the maintainer of the project will get a notification. And just like at GitHub, you get then this green button where you can automatically merge the changes. Now, some people might say, okay, it's dangerous, you should verify changes, but often a good change or fix might only be two or three lines of code that you wouldn't want to bother checking out and compiling and everything. In this case, it makes more sense to trust the person and have a look at the diff, and if you're satisfied, you push the green button and it's merged. And that's what I loved on GitLab. So that's why I moved to this. Now, for sake of completeness, there was another recommendation that I got that was Bitbucket. And it's my understanding you use Bitbucket?
Yes. Yes, I do. I do use Bitbucket, but they're very small teams for me in general. So I don't know if it's really relevant. How many people do you have working?
We are three guys plus a few external ones.
Okay. So yeah, I use Bitbucket as well. That's very similar to GitHub, actually. And I use it with Source3, which is developed by Atlassian, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have many problems with it. I got way less problems than I had with managing my own SVM back a few years ago, actually. It simplified stuff. And things that I don't have to take care of for me are valuable. That's generally how I classify them. You know, does it work? Do I have to take care of it? As long as I don't take care of it, that's pretty good. So I don't have any big complaints with it.
Now, is Bitbucket a Git server?
Yes, it is. I believe that it is. It is essentially a Git server, actually. I've got it set up as Git. I think that I don't really remember because I did that a long time ago, but I think that it offered Mercurial as well. Mm-hmm. At some point.
Do you use it self-hosted or in the cloud?
I use it in the cloud.
Yeah.
I use it in the cloud, which has... which, given the fact that we've got very, very bad connections around here, sometimes is problematic, mainly due to the internet connections. But it's true that at some point I may go, that's why I was interested by the discussion, because at some point I may go to self-hosting just to have it on our intranet.
I can definitely recommend this to you. Setting up GitLab is extremely easy because they have it's called an appliance. So it's basically a virtual machine that's totally set up that you boot up in a virtual box. So basically on the Linux machine, where you want to install that, you basically install VirtualBox, and then you have this container that contains the virtual machine that you boot up, and then you do a little bit of configuring, like domain name and stuff, but that's it. So my admin had it running within I think 15 minutes or so.
It is
amazing, and the big advantage that I wanted to say that why I'm now preferring Git over Subversion is also that each clone contains the entire history of your repository, so each clone also acts as a distributed backup.
Mm-hmm.
So should something happen to my server, which already gets backed up, I still have all the current working copies on all the other machines, and just myself, I work on two machines. So I would always have some place where I have a functioning version of my code to go back to. And the other advantage that this brings is you can have your repository clone on a laptop and work even though you don't have an internet connection. Once you have a connection back, you just push that to your master and you're back in sync, basically. And
actually, for a little history, the first time I implemented Git was because I wanted to keep my code in sync between my two machines. So I had the Mac Pro in my office and the MacBook Pro that was traveling with me pretty much everywhere, and I found that it was very much impossible to keep my my code in sync without using Git or Subversion.
Just a final thing, you mentioned Bill Dozer essentially does several things, like three things at the same time that we also do ourselves by self-hosting. So the first thing that Buildozer does is it does continuous integration. So for continuous integration, we in-house use Jenkins. And we have two Jenkins installs, one with a client in the client's network, one in our own. And once you have Jenkins configured and running, it's a really great solution. And the second thing that we then do is once the test builds are made, so we have different kinds of builds. We have continuous builds where it builds every time there's a change detected on the repository. And also another thing that I'm doing on this Jenkins, I'm building my Apple Doc documentation automatically whenever I make a change. So it will detect the change, build the documentation, and upload it to my documentation server. And then the third thing that Buildozer does that we are also doing in-house is to upload a distribution, like an ad hoc build to a server where then we have the open source part of Hockey app running. So there's a web page that clients can go to where they see the latest builds of their apps, and then they can install this over the air. So that's basically my own in-house replacement for TestFlight.
Okay.
And the only thing that TestFlight does that I can't do automatically is to get device identifiers. What TestFlight does is it installs a profile that allows them to get your device identifier, and this then they somehow put into a mobile provision profile.
You've got to do it yourself. Actually, you've got to put it inside the mobile provisioning profile by yourself.
Okay.
So what you get? So TestFlight just gives you the front end to gather the UDIDs, And basically, after that, you're exporting them one by one or en bloc, and then declaring them in on the Apple website and building up your provisioning profile and et cetera, et cetera.
And yeah, but you know, we don't have that much changing devices, so I think I could easily handle adding a few UDIDs if I had additional beta testers. So oh. I didn't see any good reason to have an extra service for that. And installing the Hockey app server part that's on Git. It's not very difficult. It's a couple of PHP scripts, and mm-hmm. well, that works very, very well for us.
And anyway, there's only so much that you can install in a year. That's only 100, and just generally you're not doing the 100 at a time.
Yeah, I as I said, we don't have that many devices. I have like 20 devices or so used up. And every year I'm cleaning out the old UDIDs, which you should do every day when your developer program expires. You should go in and remove all the old ones, because then on the next year of your subscription, you get these back and can fill them up again. If you have many test users, then it's probably easier to use test flight. But as I said, there's certain kinds of apps for enterprise or for not client apps in general, but client apps that are basically my economic life, where I wouldn't want to put them on another person's server.
And I can understand that. I can definitely understand that. Hey, by the way, talking about testing, are you still testing on iPhone 3G?
No.
No.
Why?
No. I'm just wondering what's the oldest device you're testing on before deploying.
Well, let me think about that. I think I'm now, supporting, in theory, are we supporting with apps like Urban Airship Commander? I think we're still supporting iOS 5 and their ARM 7 and ARM 7S. So that does that still include the iPhone 3G? Or is it the... No, it's the
3G. That's the 3GS, I think.
So, yeah, that's your answer. iPhone 3GS and above.
Uh-huh.
But I don't actually know if we can say that we test on that. we just assume that it works.
Okay. Hey, you know what? We're getting... I'm just looking at the clock. We're getting long again. I just wanted to mention, as we were in the tools, two tools that I'm using as well. They are not new. One of them you know very well. The other one, I don't know if you're using. Are you using it? Are you using Slender?
No, it's the first time I heard about it. Slender.
Ooh, then I'm doing you a big favor. So Slender, that's let me see. I'm opening it. That's Dave Viscus who designed it. And that's DragonForge software. That's a very nice utility for Mac, where you just drop your Xcode project folder in there. And what it does is analyze all your graphics assets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to tell you if your 1x pictures and 2x pictures are exactly 1x and 2x. So if you generated your 1x from the 2x, generally it works. If you got the 2x, for example, that has an odd dimension, it will tell you that, and it lets you check your graphics asset. It tells you automatically what is missing. which I find fantastic. And the one thing for which you will love it is actually that it allows you to clean your project. Mm-hmm. So it will tell you which assets are in there and are not needed anymore.
Awesome. And it's available on the Mac App Store. So
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah. Yes, it is. I have it in front of me.
You just checked it.
Yeah, awesome. So, I'll check that out. And the other one?
And the other one, that's Lingwon.
Ah, great app. Great app. I can definitely recommend for people to use
it. I know you can. But Lingwon, for I'm very happy to recommend it for everyone that is localizing an app. I can tell you a funny story, actually, about Lingwon. It's about localizing an app in French and English, which, since I speak fluently both, that should have been very, very easy. Except that in that messy project, so that was for the Noisy Book app, toddler app, toddler games. And the Noisy Book, there's 100 assets where you just say, for example, the car does vroom vroom. And I had to manage for this one the text, of course. So the text for every kind of sound. I had to manage the sounds. I had to manage the pictures as well. Because all the graphics assets were written by hand, by the illustrator. And with 300 assets in two different languages, you end up in a mess very, very quickly. And I would not, and basically Lingwon proved to be very good. I just had to write, when I got it, actually, after that, I just decided that I would stick to the same structure for the keys. So that I can just put everything under it. So a good time saver and life saver as well. And by the way, I got a question for you on Lingwon. It's why doesn't Apple include its set of strings? They've got all the menus that are translated in X languages. I've never found that resource anywhere.
Sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, basically, we've got all the system messages and menus that are translated in all the languages that OS X and iOS support.
You mean like the system apps or the operating system?
Yeah.
Those are string files that are on your hard disk. Let's not expand on this too much because we are already over an hour. But just let me tell you, just today I was working on something where I needed Apple's translations of certain texts. Specifically, if you look at the certificate, there are all these fields like common name and so on. If you quick look a certificate, you get all this information about the certificate. And I was looking for these strings. And I found these strings in a framework in my on my hard disk.
Okay.
So if you know what you're looking for, it might take a little bit of digging, but all the strings that you see in the system are somewhere on your hard disk.
Silly me, I look for them.
The only thing is, if you search for pure text, you might not find them, because when you build an app, typically Xcode will convert the string file into a binary plist.
Yeah.
So they are still named .strings, but they are not actually files that you can like grab for a certain string, but you have to change the extension from strings to plist, and then you can double click on it and view it inside. And do you know how many languages OS 10.8 is localized in?
Nope, I'm dying to know.
What would you think? Make a guess.
I would think about 130.
No, you would be very wrong about that. It's that the correct number is 30 languages.
30 languages? That's all?
Yeah, that's all. That seems to cover... well, okay. I have to admit, there might be some parts of the system that have more localizations, but the one file that I was looking for, which is ASN1 OID string files, there were 30 localizations for that.
And the App Store is available in 159 countries right now?
Yeah, but it's not 159 languages.
Of course, it's not 159 languages, but even though you've still got specifics, like you've got five different types of English or French or French Canadian, French Switzerland. That's not the same language. Well, that's the same language.
It might be different for user interface things. The strings files I'm looking at here is in Security Foundation under resources, and the only language where they have two variants is Chinese, because they have Taiwanese Chinese and Chinese Chinese. All the other ones, like English or French, they only have one version.
They only have one.
So,
okay.
As I said before, it might be that certain apps where you have more user interface things, they have more languages, but the Security Foundation framework is only localized in 30 languages.
Okay. Do you think that they use Lingua?
I once had a dealing with an Apple engineer who was actually using a part that's included in Lingua to scan UIKit. And he told me that he found a few problems. So the component that I'm talking about is GenStrings 2, which is a open source replacement I wrote for GenStrings. But I wrote it such that it's basically a static library that you can include in your own app, like I did with Lingua, or you can. There's a command line utility demo that has the same functionality as GenStrings. So this Apple engineer that I'm talking about used this to scan UIKit, and he told me that he found a few problems that they fixed later. So. That's
made your day.
Say again?
That made your day.
That made my day, yeah. so yeah, let's call it a episode.
Let's call it a day.
And stop here. Hey, it's been another great episode. We had quite a few tools to talk about. So we called this week's episode Week of Tools. And if you have some feedback for us, dear listener, don't hesitate. Tweet us, email us, leave comments on the Coconetics website. And I hope you like what we did here, and hope to be seeing you again next week when we do another episode of the Coconetics podcast. Bye, Dave.
Bye. Hey, Oliver. See you next week.